Cassette 7, Side 1. And the sight of John in his bed shocked me. In photographs taken a month before, he had looked merely sick. Now his legs and arms were emaciated. You could see all the bones in them, and his knee and elbow joints looked outsize, with the flesh shrunk away. He'd been given a tracheotomy. A round peg to accommodate a feeding tube was fixed in the front of his neck, on either side of which bulb-shaped lumps of flesh stood out. The swellings forced his tongue from his mouth. He was shifting around, clearly trying to find a way to take the pressure off his neck. He made a gurgling sound, secretions clogging his airways. A nurse suctioned them out with an electrical device. On top of everything else, he was running a fever. I couldn't look at him again right away. I glanced around the room instead and found myself staring at a baby with kwashiorkor in the crib near the stairs. Her eyes looked immense, like the eyes of a frightened woodland creature. I looked at John's mother, a dark-skinned, very thin woman. She sat on the side of the bed, staring at nothing, it seemed. No expression at all on her face. I looked at Serena and saw that she, too, was looking away, gazing at the wall above John's bed, her lips pursed. She was silent for a long moment, which seemed to stretch into minutes. Then she thrust her hands through her hair and said, "Okay, we need to know why he has a fever, what meds he's on." She started leafing through John's records, and Carol went to John's bedside. The boy was gesturing at Carol's black purse. He wanted to see what was in it. Carol opened it and held it toward him. He poked his fingers around inside, then waved dismissively at it as if to say, "Nothing interesting in there." Carol leaned over him and spoke softly in Creole. "Papé." "Don't be afraid," she said, and tears began to roll down John's cheeks, pearly in the dim light of the children's pavilion. The two doctors and T. Fifi moved away from the bed to confer. "The most reassuring thing to me right now is he's totally a kid," said Carol. She went on, "His spleen and liver are not enlarged. The only thing is his congestion." "I think the congestion will be better with him sitting up," Serena said. She was thinking about trying to get him on the plane tomorrow. Maybe she could cover his neck with a blanket. The image didn't work, though. "I don't think we can take him on a commercial airline. I don't think they'd let him on board. So why don't we just figure out how we take him on another plane? Carol, do we or do we not take him tomorrow on a commercial plane?" "The one thing that's going to kill him are these secretions," said Carol. "I think it would be irresponsible as a physician to take him, without suction, on a plane." Serena went over the situation. The chief pediatric oncologist at Mass General had told her that John had a reasonable chance if the cancer had not metastasized into his bones, and there was no way of telling here in Cange if that had happened. "He has to have his fighting chance," Serena said. T. Fifi said, "Maybe we can get a helicopter to Port-au-Prince and then a medevac flight." She looked thoughtful. "I don't know what a medevac flight will cost." "Maybe $20,000, said Carol. "Let's just pay it," said Serena. Now I'm like, big deal. What's $20,000? What if he died on the plane? I can see the story. Harvard doctors from PIH totally irresponsible. Jim would kill me. I shouldn't have left this little boy here a month ago. I feel very responsible. Next time I'll be quicker. We didn't even have a diagnosis a month ago, said Carol. I'm just bummed because I should have brought him back a month ago, said Serena. We dicked around waiting for a diagnosis. Carol looked down. The plastic bag with farmer's new shabunkins was sitting on the floor. Shit! I brought them all this way. They're not going to die now. They took a break and walked across the Guo Wut La with flashlights to farmer's Ti Kai and turned on the lights to his fish pond. Carol looked down into the plastic bag and said, "That's Jean-Claude and Yolanda. I'll miss you too, kids, but you gotta go ahead and make some friends." She dumped them in the pond, and we bent over and watched the fish swim off among the others. At dawn, Serena and Tififi headed back to Port-au-Prince to look for a medevac and a helicopter. It was a long day. When the truck reached the paved road at the foot of Morne Cabrit, Alex, Zami La Santé's driver, accelerated to 70 miles an hour and went into the city scattering chickens and dwarf goats. He pulled out into oncoming traffic to pass camions and tap-taps, making a third lane on the road, which had only two, and sometimes making a fourth as he pulled out to pass vehicles that had themselves pulled out to pass. Carol had said there was a special beep that drivers made on their horns in Port-au-Prince to announce, "I'm coming around this corner in the wrong lane," and the saying in her girlhood was that if you made that beep and then heard another like it coming from the other direction, you prayed you would die in the collision so as not to be sent to the central hospital. I told myself that, if I were a Haitian, I'd compete wildly to get a leg up on anything I could, and probably be an anarchic driver, too. And then I thought that here were Serena and Tififi trying to save a boy's life, while Alex, sweetly smiling at the wheel, was putting dozens of other lives in jeopardy. Just now, those of two boys sharing a bicycle, the truck's side mirror nearly brushing their shoulders. When we got stuck in the traffic near the airport, I felt relieved, for a while. We were in and out of traffic jams all day, traveling to Tififi's family's house in the city, where there was a computer hooked up to the internet, then to the airport, then to the office of a friend of Tififi's who had a fax machine, then back to the airport, then back to her place. There was lots of time to see the sights by the sides of the city roads. The brightly painted wooden booths selling lottery tickets, the proprietor's hopes preying on hope. Bank Lotto, New York. The rubble by the sides of the streets, old tires, trash, ragged chunks of concrete, skeletons of trucks and cars stripped as clean as bones in a desert. Men sitting with shotguns on their knees outside every gas station. Dying men and women begging. People on crutches, people with the stumps of their legs inserted in what looked like ice cream containers. Up ahead in traffic, I saw a camion with a legend painted on its rear window which seemed to sum up Serena and Tififi's problem for today. "O Morne Cabrit," it read. A medevac flight from Port-au-Prince to Boston was fairly easy to arrange. It entailed only several phone calls and one traffic jam. But the price was $18,540. Serena was ready to pay it and raise the money later, but Tififi wanted Farmer's approval. Serena had sent him this email. "John's condition is growing more tenuous. He is curious, sweet as can be, interactive with us, and they would not have let him on the plane. And yet, weak, 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 and I fear would not survive the trip to the airport, and they would not have let him on the plane. Polo, I know this sounds crazy, but he still has his fighting chance. This could still be a localized tumor, with abscess tipping him over and increased mass size. I will take responsibility to pay for this flight. We are proceeding with plan while we wait to hear from you." But Farmer seemed worried about the expense, and perhaps the precedent of a medevac flight. He'd written back, "Serena, honey, please consider other possibilities." This message left Tififi looking worried, which was unusual. Sitting by her computer, she said, "Usually Paul would say, 'I trust you, go ahead.' He would never say, 'Don't do it,' but if he wanted us to do it, he would say so." "So in the context of Polo, this is a no," said Serena. "It's close," said Tififi. "There's other consequences to this. What are we going to do if another kid like this comes to us? It's not a one-time thing. We're not going to close the hospital after this. It's really tricky. The staff will be asking, 'Why did they spend this money?' Paul's worried about it." "I'm looking at only one child," Serena said. "That's the thing," said Tififi. "There are so many kids waiting for heart surgery, and the staff is asking for more money. A medevac flight is not something you do in Haiti." Softly, as if to herself, she added, "I am sure that people will say, 'If your child is sick, go to Cange, and they will fly him to Boston.' In the Central Plateau, this is going to be an event." "I have an idea," said Serena. "Just have me pay for it, and tell everyone in Cange that I did." She added, The fact that he has free care at the other end makes it excruciating.
We should get all the arrangements and the cost, and ask Paul, said Tififi, because I know this guy.
Serena seemed on the verge of tears. Tififi got up and hugged her. Tififi, whose head barely reached the level of Serena's shoulders, reaching up, Serena bending her knees to receive the hug. Tififi laughed softly, saying,
More and more patients. Every day something. A crisis, like John.
This is nothing.
Every day, every minute, you have cases like this. Someone's sick, someone's in danger.
Then Tififi got on the computer and wrote Farmer,
You have to say yes or no.
I imagined him receiving this message, restive in a Bavarian castle. His reply came fairly quickly. He wrote, of the cost of the medevac, Well, it could be worse. Also, I'll be there within 24 hours, but would not try to second-guess all of you there. Getting him on a plane is the only way to save his life, so I'm for it. He closed. In any case, his hope is in leaving Haiti, by one way or another. Like many other Haitians, alas. But there was still the matter of getting John down Highway 3 to Port-au-Prince.
He will die on the road, one of Zami La Santé's Haitian doctors had said last night.
This seemed far from unlikely to me. Tififi had searched through the airport for someone with a helicopter, but there appeared to be none in Haiti, at least none available to her, and she was very well connected. Perhaps a small plane would do, but no landing strip existed anywhere near Cange. So John would have to be taken down the road, over its boulders and giant potholes, across the streams. Tififi didn't like the prospect.
I'm not giving up, she said to Serena. But what is best for John?
He will be in his mother's lap in the truck, said Serena. Tififi, I know he looks very weak, but I think it's criminal not to try.
Okay, said Tififi.
The reason I feel so strongly about it is I talked to Paul about this.
Paul is not here, said Tififi.
She sighed, then smiled.
There's no point arguing. It's the same, you know, circle.
If only we'd brought manual suction, said Serena. This now looked like the insuperable problem. Without a suctioning device, John might well asphyxiate on the trip to Port-au-Prince, and the only suctioning devices in Cange were electrical. None would work in the truck. Tififi wondered if they could hire an ambulance with its own device. She worked her contacts and found a publicly owned ambulance that would have done the job for free if it hadn't been broken down and in the shop. Tififi shook her head and smiled at this news.
Only God can help us, she said.
Then she got on the phone again and located a private ambulance company. It was on John Brown Avenue, an outfit called Sam's Service Ambulance. The company owned one vehicle. It was shiny but old. A Kennedy, a recycled American model from around the 1970s, and it didn't have four-wheel drive. Nevertheless, Ralph, the proprietor, was willing to try the road to Cange. He was a fit-looking, muscular fellow. He'd served in the U.S. Army for 10 years and had come back to Haiti to build a little business, hoping, he said, to do his part to help his native country. But while Haiti had plenty of need for ambulances, there weren't many people who could pay for one, and he'd grown discouraged. Why not, he seemed to feel, give this job a try? He and four of his men got dressed for the journey. They put on T-shirts that read, Sam's Service Ambulance, and white hard hats, and climbed into their vehicle. Then they turned on their siren and led the way out of Port-au-Prince at high speed, calling back, Follow us! Through the loudspeaker mounted on their roof. The ambulance broke down for the first time about halfway up Morne Cabrit. It was dark and pouring rain by then. Sitting in the Zami La Santé truck, parked on the edge of the cliff, we watched one of Ralph's men pour quart after quart of oil into the ambulance's engine. The headlights of both vehicles angled sharply upward. I noticed the rainwater. It was running with the volume of a small brook down the so-called road, a dry riverbed no more, and I wondered what would happen if the rain didn't stop. And what about the Zengland, though? the bandits who were said to prey on broken-down travelers. T. Fifi was a very calm person, and even she had said she didn't like to be out on the Guowood La after dark, because of the Zanglindo. But Farmer had said that Haitians don't like being out in the rain, and maybe this generalization applied to the Zanglindo too. We sat inside the truck waiting for about half an hour. No ambulance meant no suction device. For the lack of a simple manually operated tool, all the work would be spoiled and the boy's life forfeit. I was immersed in these thoughts when Serena said, "Well, guys, we did it. He's flying out tomorrow." I said, "Serena, that isn't clear yet." "But you gotta rejoice a little along the way," she said. Then she started in on worries that seemed remarkably premature. "We have to have the ambulance get to Port-au-Prince right when the plane arrives tomorrow, so that John gets to Mass General before 5 p.m. if possible, because..." I muttered, I'm ashamed to say, that Sam's service ambulance wasn't going to make it up, mourned Cabrit, never mind to Cange, and Serena began to cry. Then, just as I'd begun to apologize, T. Fifi's cell phone rang. It was Ralph, calling from a few yards away. "They're still going to try?" Serena asked. "I guess so," said T. Fifi. "Oh, I love them," said Serena. T. Fifi chuckled. "God is good." But about two-thirds of the way to the summit, the ambulance stopped again. In the stage set that our headlights made, you could see steam pouring out from under the hood. A couple of Ralph's men came outside in their hard hats and ponchos and rolled a large rock behind one of the ambulance's wheels. T. Fifi's cell phone rang again. "They have tried," T. Fifi said to Serena, "but now they are low on oil again, and they don't have any more." "But maybe they'll loan us their suction," said Serena. "If they will, we will have to pay them something," said T. Fifi. "Pay them lots," said Serena. After a little palaver, Ralph said, "No problem." Serena was cheerful again. She and T. Fifi got out and climbed into the back of the ambulance to watch the men work. Inside the Zami La Santé truck, Patrice, one of the hospital workers, shook his head. "I think Serena, she never gives up." A female version of Farmer in this respect, I thought. But I didn't see what good it would do to transfer the suction device. It was electrical. It would take better mechanics than these guys to hook it up to Zami La Santé's truck in the middle of the night during a rainstorm on the slopes of Morne Cabrit. Hours, it seemed like hours, went by. The rain had let up. I stood outside and listened to Ralph and his men at work. There was a lot of banging and scraping. It sounded as if they were tearing the whole ambulance apart. I poked my head inside the back door and heard Ralph say to T. Fifi, "You should have me run transportation for your hospital, and I'm telling you, no problems." I thought, yeah, sure, as you mangle your broken-down ambulance. It is so easy, at least for me, to mistake a person's material resources for his interior ones. I stood at the edge of the cliff and gazed at the lights of Port-au-Prince far below. More time went by. And then I saw Serena's hand appear out of the back of the ambulance with the thumb turned upward. And moments later, Ralph was carrying the suction device to the truck. He had mounted it on a board and wired it to a plug that would fit the socket of the truck's cigarette lighter. He leaned into the cab, inserted the plug, and the machine began whirring. Serena clapped her hands. Then T. Fifi said we should go back to Port-au-Prince for the night and get another truck, because there would be no room for Serena and me and Patrice inside this one tomorrow. And Serena said, "No, we can't do that. It would mean another day's delay." She and I would ride to the airport tomorrow in the open bed of the truck. "That's what Paul would say. Get your ass in the back." The streams that cross Highway 3 were swollen. They looked like rapids in the headlights, and Alex actually paused at the first one, then plunged the truck in. For a moment, our lights were shining through water, and then we were across. Later, Serena would tell me that she had been very frightened. "What if I die?" she said she had thought, when the headlights went underwater. "I can't die," she had answered herself. "I have so much life left." And then, as the truck had struggled up onto dry land, shuddering like a beast shaking off water, she'd said to herself, "Okay, remember that. If it's your life, it's always the most important thing." The party made an early start for Port-au-Prince the next morning. As usual, there was a crowd of patients in the courtyard. They watched solemnly as Dr. Hugo Jerome carried John in his arms out to the truck. He kissed the boy, then placed him in the back seat beside his mother and Carol. Dr. J, as I called him, was one doctor who, I believed, would never leave Cange for a better posting. One time in my presence, he'd raised a glass of Haitian rum and said to Farmer, "You are the best Haitian I know." Alex rose to the occasion. He drove very slowly over the craters of Highway 3, and the long stretches of lumpy, fissured bedrock, and the steep inclines where the dirt track was just piles of boulders. Inside the truck, Carol and John's mother ministered to the boy. He suffered, every bump a sharp pain. "Imagine your worst sore throat times 1,000, Carol said. But the suction device never quit, and John arrived safely at the airport, and safely in Boston, perhaps the first Haitian peasant ever to have traveled in a Learjet. At Logan, an ambulance came onto the tarmac and picked us all up. I rode in front with the driver. He told me, "It's gonna get real rough." "How so?" "The roads. There's a lot of bad road between here and Mass General." This should have been comic, but I couldn't begin to explain that to the driver. And for some reason I couldn't name, this made me sad. The little jet had landed once, in Wilmington, North Carolina, so we could all clear customs. The agent had asked Serena the perfunctory question, "Did you bring anything back from Haiti?" Then the agent had added, "Not that you'd get anything there anyhow except disease." Back in the plane, Serena had said, "I wanted to slug her right in the nose, but I'm a total pacifist." In Wilmington, Serena had put on a dress. Her other clothes had been soiled with dust from the Guaout La. "I can't go into Mass General looking like this," she had said. She was worried enough as it was about what the nurses and doctors there would say when they saw John. It was a prescient worry. The team at the pediatric intensive care unit was quick and deft, and had John in bed in an instant. But Serena overheard one of the doctors on duty say over the phone to her boss, "He's all neck and bones." And so when Farmer called from Haiti, Serena said, "Hey, we did the right thing." Farmer was agreeing emphatically, I could tell, and Serena said again, "So, Polo, we did the right thing. I have no doubt we did the right thing." In a little while, Serena and I went to a room nearby to eat the hospital supper. An intern, a young woman, joined us. She looked very young, indeed almost adolescent, and she was just out of medical school, whereas Serena was an attending physician at the Brigham. But the intern was clearly too upset to care about protocol. "Hadn't they been feeding this child in Haiti?" she asked. "I'm shocked," she said. She added, as if lecturing a student, "Dying from chemotherapy is terrible, you know." Serena pursed her lips. She had begun to try to explain. One had to understand what Haiti was like, and how hard it was to get someone back from there. And of course John was malnourished. But Paul Farmer, who was a famous doctor, had ordered that John be fed aggressively, and had even arranged for a feeding tube, which was something rarely done in Haiti. But even the head pediatric oncologist at Mass General had said that no amount of nourishment would fatten up a child afflicted with this kind of cancer, and John still had his fighting chance. When a small, trim, middle-aged man in a black suit walked into the room. "Dr. Alan Ezekowitz, the head of pediatrics." I wondered if he could possibly have overheard the intern lecturing Serena, because the first thing he said in a loud, brassy voice, smiling at Serena, was, "Well, this boy is a challenge, but I've cured sicker kids." Serena laughed nervously. She said, "Well,
Now he's in man's greatest hospital. That was what Mass General people called the place, playing on its initials, MGH. Dr. Ezekowitz chuckled. As soon as we start to believe that, we won't be. He turned to the young intern. Isn't that right? We can always do better, can't we? The intern bowed her head. Yes, Dr. Ezekowitz. The next afternoon, Serena called me and said that a formidable phalanx of radiologists, pediatricians, and cancer doctors had just spent an hour studying John's x-rays and bone scans and CT scans. Then, weeping over the phone, she said, as if all in one breath, It's everywhere. It's in his mouth. It grows into the vertebral bodies. The poor kid has been in horrible pain. It started at the nasal area, just one solid tumor, growing back into the spinal column, the roof of the mouth. You can't radiate four vertebral bodies. So he's going to die. He's getting excellent care. But there's still a bit of, why did you bring him? Why? Because A, he's a human being. And B, because I didn't know he couldn't be treated. And C, why shouldn't he have a comfortable way to die? Why shouldn't his mother have a private room without flies on her face to grieve in? Can we not have him in a place where people are trained in palliation? Isn't palliative care important? And a place where his mother can grieve in private instead of an open ward with flies all over her face? John did get first-rate care, of course, and all the right drugs at the right doses, so that he was never in apparent pain again. Serena and Carol spent most of the next 2 weeks in his room, taking turns sleeping there on a cot. John's favorite toy was a broken child's tape recorder, which had a play phone attached. He'd pick it up and speak into it. Who are you talking to? Carol asked him in Creole.
My mother.
What are you telling her?
Vini, Vini. Come quick.
He motioned for Carol to say the same words over the phone, and she did. And he was satisfied. His mother arrived within several days, along with T. Fifi, who had made the arrangements. Farmer spent a great deal of time with John in his hospital room. Every PIHer visited, and so did many from Boston's Haitian community, and his room, it had a lofty view out over the Charles River, was crammed full of toys. Serena set up her apartment as a hospice, and a couple of days after John was moved there, he simply didn't wake up. Carol sat on the bed beside him and listened, her hand on his wrist. He had Cheney Stokes' respiration, shallow and quick, and then a minute of apnea, and then she couldn't feel his pulse. It seemed to me that things had turned out as well as they could have for John, under the circumstances of Haiti. PIHers spoke in fiery terms about those. Several said to each other, Thank you for not letting him die there. Not that anyone was pleased at the outcome. The fact was, the boy might have lived if he could have been extracted from Haiti sooner. But there were other consequences, surprising and consoling. Farmer offered John's mother a job at Zomi La Santé, and a large collection was taken up for her. T. Fifi warned against giving her too much money at any one time, which was a good thing. An object lesson in how dangerous good intentions can be in a place as poor as Haiti. In the Central Plateau, word travels more quickly than most people do, and it stood to reason that a woman whose child had been flown in a jet to the United States, to Pays Cob, Moneyland, would have some cash lying around. Robbers broke into her family's house outside Hanche. But thanks to T. Fifi, there wasn't anything there worth stealing, and the thieves didn't return. As for T. Fifi's fear that parents would besiege Zomi La Santé with demands that their sick children be flown to Boston too, nothing like that occurred. The next time I was in Cange, I asked Zomi La Santé's chief handyman, T. Jean, what the people in the region were saying about the case. He told me that everyone talked about it.
And you know what they say? They say, look how much they care about us.
Serena had worried
that this might be the last time Mass General would give one of their Haitian patients free care, but less than a month after John died, she was flying back from Haiti with another child, a little girl from a village across the reservoir from Cange, with a malignant tumor on her kidney, but excellent prospects, and well enough to fly commercially. Mass General was waiving the cost of her care. The staff in pediatrics had warmed up considerably to Serena and Carol, Dr. Ezekowitz especially. He was impressed at the attention they'd paid to their patient, and liked to have his own staff witness it. He sought out Serena and said,
"You're a great advocate for your patient. You must be proud of yourself."
She said, "I'm not proud of myself. Patients are dying in Haiti. The mess Haiti's in is nothing to be proud of." But this was an opening she wasn't going to miss. "Dr. Ezekowitz, I would like to explore a collaborative effort. Do you think you'd like to meet Paul Farmer?" Ezekowitz was eager to meet him, in fact. He knew of Farmer.
"I think Paul is quite remarkable," he told me later.
He said he thought that hospitals like Mass General had a responsibility to provide free care to patients like John. "And I think free care serves an important purpose in that it centers people. Poverty in a place like Haiti is difficult to personalize. If it's in front of you, it has a reality." So the meeting came off well. Farmer said, "If I might be so candid, we need help. What would you think of taking a couple of our patients a year?" And Dr. Ezekowitz said,
"Oh, I think as a minimum."
Watching the PIHers extract John from Cange, I had at moments in my darkest thoughts worried that the event might have more to do with them than with John, more to do with proving the organization's capacity for heroics than with saving a child. But then I thought, an idea like that would never have occurred to me if John had been my son. You do all you can for a patient. If I were seriously ill myself, I wouldn't find that policy unreasonable. And yet a feeling lingered with me that the whole episode was like an object lesson in the difficulty of Farmer's enterprise, perhaps in its ultimate futility. I planned to ask him for his thoughts about the case, after a decent interval. Chapter 26. It's December, 2 months since the medevac flight to Boston, and I'm back here with Farmer again, on the other side of the Great Epi Divide. In the last light of the day, the outskirts of Port-au-Prince look the same to me as on every previous trip. Chaotic, squalid, broken down. For a time, driving out of the city toward the Quasmans of Morne Cabrit, we follow a tap-tap with some words of social commentary painted on its bumper. In translation from the Creole, they read, "Lord, a word on all this." Farmer laughs. As he drives into the mountains, driving fast as always, the headlights bounding over ruts and boulders, I ask him how many emails he is receiving now. "About 200 a day," he says. "It's still doable," which is what he said a year ago when he got about 75 a day. He tells me, "Something's got to give. But as has been noted, I'm not burning out." In the light from the dashboard, I see his jaw stiffen, a momentarily pugnacious look. And I'm not jaded, either. Once again, we arrive in Cange, jostled and long after dark. But without mishap, no accidents, no encounters with Zenglando, and Farmer gets out of his suit and into his Haiti clothes, and we sit down under the bower, dripping with vines, outside his tikai. Tijan brings us supper and joins us. Tijan is a muscular man with a wild grin, the son of a local peasant farmer. He's about 30, old enough to have witnessed all the stages of the transformation of Cange.
"It's a marvel," he says. "People were living here like pigs in a pig pen, but now you have to knock on their doors."
That is, he's saying, they now have doors. In addition to his role as chief handyman, Tijan serves as Farmer's main local male confidant. My chief of staff, Farmer calls him. He has the right attributes. Tijan gives portions of his own salary to destitute patients. He has said about National Highway 3, I'd rather we have a fixed road and 100,000 extra patients a year, because it's our vocation to receive them. He has told me that if he were a philosophe, if, that is, his family had owned enough pigs to send him to high school, he would write a book about the Haitian bourgeoisie, an angry book, he says. He knows something about medicine and shares farmers' scorn for notions that they're special virtue in a culture's old technologies, in the idea, for instance, that herbal remedies are generally to be preferred over manufactured drugs. He is also one of farmers' chief informants on local beliefs. To Tijan, animals aren't always what they seem. See that black dog, Polo? Was it here yesterday? No. And did it bark twice? Yes. Tijan will nod knowingly. Mm-hmm. In Tijan's cosmology, as Farmer understands it, people turn themselves into animals for shifty reasons only, or else sorcerers turn them into animals as punishment, or simply for food. Farmer interprets all this as a giant morality play, a commentary on social inequality. He adds, almost invariably. After we eat, Farmer turns on the underwater lights in his fish pond, then gazes in, naming the species. A good guest now has to join him over the fish. I say this seems to have replaced hortatorture. No, says Farmer, still gazing in. It's the same as hortatorture. Tijan remarks that the pond cost a lot of money, then says to Farmer, as if I wouldn't approve. It's not one thing that makes you happy. If you only saw patients, you might not be happy. What about all his travel? Farmer asks him. Tijan allows that Farmer travels a lot. You're like a nestless bird, he says. Where is my nest? Farmer asks. Your nest is Haiti, says Tijan. You go everywhere, but this is your base. Of the patients I met on my previous visits, a few have long since been buried. Many more have gone home, and some have stayed. A lot of the staff involved in teaching disease prevention are former patients. They tend to be zealous, and they have credibility, and besides, some got sick in the first place because they were especially vulnerable. A year ago, there was a family of five here all being treated for MDR. They've all been cured and have left, except for one of the sons. He believed he was responsible for infecting the rest of his family and was so extremely laden with guilt and so neurotic about so many other things that Farmer decided he couldn't send him away to compete for food again. So he's hired him as a TB outreach worker. T. Ofa, the young man who told Farmer that he wanted to give him a chicken or a pig, has gained 8 pounds since he started taking anti-AIDS drugs. The old woman who believed her son had killed his brother through sorcery has come around after many consultations. And the lawyer Farmer hired has finally got the young security guard from Cai Epin cleared of all charges and out of jail. But in a place where medicine is still scarce, and where food is scarcer than ever, and the legal system is at best rudimentary, there will always be more sorcery consults and prison extractions to come. And always more patients, of course. Some months back, a boy named Alcante arrived at Zame La Santé's children's pavilion. Like John, he had lumps on his neck, but his were in fact symptomatic of scrofula. First-line drugs wiped out the infection. The swellings disappeared, leaving only a few small scars, and Alcante gained 8 pounds, about 10% of his total weight. The boy was 13 and seemed younger because he was so small and trusting. He was the kind of child who takes strangers by the hand, and he was very beautiful looking. A perfect little body, shiny dark eyes, dimples. He changed the atmosphere in the children's pavilion and lessened the tightening Farmer felt in his chest as he climbed the stairs to that wing. For Farmer, the children's ward contained Jaime La Santé's most harrowing sights and painful ghosts, and I think Alcante came to seem like the guardian angel of the place, or like Farmer's. He kept the boy in Cange several weeks longer than necessary. He called him a P.O.P., a prisoner of Paul. Finally, he sent him home. As a rule, a child with scrofula gets it from a close contact, usually the mother or father. So one of Jaime La Santé's community health workers brought the rest of Alcante's family to Cange. They were trolled in, as Farmer puts it. Several had TB, including Alcante's father, who is still in therapy. Now Farmer wants to see for himself what home means to Alcante. He plans to hike to their homestead. The family is so afflicted, he explains, then adds, some people would say this is a scattershot approach. We would answer, not at all. It's through journeys to the sick that we identify needs and problems. Alcante lives in a town called Cas. The hike is longer than the first long one I took with him to mourn Michel, but the trails aren't as steep. This is what Farmer told me last night, so I have only a vague idea of how many hours the trip will take, until we're walking out the front gate, and Tijan, who is coming with us, asks if I have brought my flashlight. I haven't. I offer to go back for it. Farmer doesn't think I should. Inevitably, some emergency will have cropped up, and going back will get him entangled in it. Delay now will mean further delay. Farmer is wearing a baseball cap, which looks a few sizes too large, and for a moment I imagine him a gawky teenager on the way to a ball game with his dad. His thin frame and the shininess of his face make this possible, and also a quality of innocence that surfaces at times. He's apt, for example, in the midst of an erudite discourse on the economic distribution of infectious disease, to startle you by interjecting eagerly, "Ask me a question about Lord of the Rings." He's reread those books again and again over the years since he was 11. But now he's leading the way out of Jaime La Santé, in every sense the man in charge, and I realize I'm not worried about the flashlight. This strikes me as unusual. I've never found it easy to trust another person to lead me anywhere. But I trust Farmer. We head off along dirt paths etched into the sides of the hills beside the Peligue Reservoir, and soon I'm scrambling up the eroded face of a cliff. I'm drenched with sweat by the time we get to the top, where Farmer is waiting for me. I'm reminded of the epic hike to Mont Michel. As we go on, Farmer calls back over his shoulder. His voice makes it plain he's joking, that if I have chest pains, I should tell him right away. I take a long swig of water as we stride across a ridge through yellow grass, Farmer pointing out the peculiarly steep and conical hill on which he sat in solitude years ago, writing aides and accusation. Tijan is carrying a large water jug filled from a tap at the medical complex. It's potable water. Farmer and Tijan have immunity to whatever microorganisms it contains, but American visitors who drink it often come down with bowel troubles, not dangerously, but uncomfortably. So I brought my own jug of filtered water, but it isn't very large. By the time we make our first stop, I've drunk half, and Tijan and Farmer and Jaime La Santé's pharmacist, who is also coming along, haven't even opened their jug. Farmer has planned an intermediate house call on the way to Alcante's home in Cas. Somewhere in the mountains, we stop at a hut. Two tiny rooms, dirt floors, a roof of banana fronds, pro-Aristide posters on the walls, and an elderly-looking couple sitting together on a straw mat. Farmer has brought along the man's medical records. He sits down on a chair near the doorway and reads aloud from them. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.